Hello and welcome to another episode of Battleground 44 with me, Saul David, and Patrick Bishop. Today we're talking to historian and journalist Guy Walters about the great escape of prisoners of war from Stalag Luft 3 in Sagan, East Germany, now Poland, that took place 80 years ago this month. Guy is the author of a number of books on the Second World War and Nazi Germany, including The Voice of War, Hunting Evil, and, most relevant to today's subject, The Real Great Escape. Guy, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
It's an absolute pleasure. I'm a big fan. But Battleground 44 is a slightly new one for me. So yeah, very happy to be here.
Yeah, well, you have two hats, journalist and historian, and we're really using the historian hat this time. And we're going all the way back to almost 80 years ago this month. Well, it is 80 years ago this month, The Great Escape. Most Brits know about it, of course, from the classic war film starring Steve McQueen and Richard Attenborough. And we'll come on to the film, no doubt, and how historically accurate it is. But first, tell us a little bit about the location, Stalag Luft 3. When and why was it selected as the site of a POW camp? And how big did it become by the events of 1944?
Stalag Luft 3 became a very, very big POW camp by 44, around the time of the Great Escape. You know, there were tens of thousands of Allied POWs there. It's about 100 miles southeast of Berlin. It's in Silesia, which was German before the war, and now, of course, is part of Poland. And the reason why it was located there is because, A, it was near a massive railway junction, so it was very easy to get prisoners there. And B, the soil around there is very, very sandy, which means it's very difficult to dig tunnels. So the idea was that, you know, digging through sand, if you've ever done it, you know, on a beach as a kid or with your kids, you know, eventually when you dig a big hole in the beach, eventually it collapses on you. So that was one of the reasons why it was there. But it was run by the German Air Force, and the prisoners were largely downed airmen. And they weren't just British or Americans. They were from every Allied nation you can imagine. So it was a real sort of melting pot, if you like, of different nationalities. And Stalag Luft 3 itself was part of a network of other POW camps in that area. And today, you know, you can still see some of the remains, you know, very much there in the woods. I have to say, it is a very, very depressing place. It is very flat, very sandy, full of fir trees and nothing else. Oh, and a few poles going around picking mushrooms. And it's a very kind of barren place. So if you are a downed Spitfire pilot, you know, living in Surrey, and then 48 hours later, you find yourselves, you know, in the middle of this forest in Silesia, you know, it was a real shock to the system.
Guys, say, can you tell us something about the kind of ethos of escaping? I think there's a kind of misunderstanding about this. So I think the number of people who found themselves behind the wire, who actually wanted to escape, was pretty small. And of those who did try it, inevitably, they didn't have much success. So it really came down to a handful of obsessives, I suppose you could say. What drove those people? Why did they try and escape over and over again?
Yeah, I mean, Patrick, you're absolutely right. And one of the sort of themes in my book, The Real Great Escape, which you know, stuck in quite a few people's craw, was dismantling this idea that every POW is this sort of chap very eager to escape all the time and have a crack at the Huns, if you like. You know, according, and this is not my statistic. I mean, you just see some inveterate escaper like Jimmy James, who said that he was very much in the minority. He estimated 2/3 of people had literally no interest in escaping because they thought that A, it was pointless, B, it was dangerous, and C, you know, they'd done their bit. I think especially in a camp full of downed airmen, you've got to remember that every single person in that camp, with a very few exceptions, had been in an air crash. And when I talk to, you know, I give talks about the Great Escape to people, I always ask, you know, put your hands up if you've been in a plane crash. And in 10 years of giving talks about it, only one person's put up their hand. And he says, that's when I, you know, pranged my Cessna in a parking lot. You know what I mean? So but every single man there, you know, had some form of trauma. And, you know, one example of that is, you know, as a boy, you know, when you were sleeping in a place with bunk beds, you might have always wanted the top bunk because that was the one you wanted to be on to fart on top of your friend or something like that. Well, you know, these young men never wanted the top bunk because they always had nightmares of falling out the sky. And so whenever, you know, a chap arrived and was given the top bunk, it was considered the worst place to be because they often fell out, you know, and they had these terrible dreams. So you've got to remember that most of these chaps do not want to get in a plane again. They don't think that there's much chance of, you know, getting hundreds of miles across occupied Europe back to Biggin Hill. the chances of that are very, very slim. And even if they do make it back, it's really going to make very little, you know, difference to the war effort.
But there were some of these obsessives, of course. And one of them, guys, is the central figure in the book, of course, squadron leader Roger Bushell. He's played as Roger Bartlett in the film, I've noticed. They slightly change his name, played by Richard Attenborough. And he's head of the escape committee. But tell us a little bit about Bushell. You know, what made the man? What was his backstory and how did he end up in Luft 3?
Bushell was a, I find him a controversial figure. No doubt we'll sort of come onto that a little bit. He's called Bartlett in the film just to give the film a bit of license. But Bushell was a very, I suppose today we'd call him an alpha male. He was South African by birth, came from a very, very well-off family. His father was made his fortune out of mining. Bushell had been to public school in the UK. He had been to Wellington, which of course is quite a military school. He was very good at rugby. He was bright but lazy academically. He ended up at Cambridge, where he scraped a third, but nevertheless became a barrister. And he was also a very keen pilot. So I'm not as much of a kind of Air Force historian as, our mutual friend Jim Holland, but he joined the Millionaire Squadron. And, you know, he'd be sort of driving up and down, you know, roads west out of London in his sports car to fly a kind of plane at the weekends. And then they'd all head back to White's to get drunk. You know, he spent a lot of his father's money on partying hard in London. He liked girls and girls liked him. And he also, whenever he was on the radio in his aeroplane, he swore a lot. And, you know, he was reprimanded by some of the women who worked in the kind of nascent air traffic control were very insulted by the fact that he swore all the time over the radio waves. And he would use his plane to get around to court cases as a barrister. So he was a very flamboyant figure, a very sort of big figure. And he was not the type of person, as a squadron leader on the first day of operations, 10th of May 1940, to get shot down. But of course, the first day of operations, 10th of May 1940, he gets shot down. And that for him is a blow. And so by the time he emerges into Stalag Luft 3, he has spent the past 3 years planning escape attempts, leading escape attempts, going on escape attempts. And he has got literally within fingernail distance of the Swiss border and then recaptured again. So by the time he arrives in Stalag Luft 3, he's gone from being this quite portly, jovial figure, and there's a drawing of him in my book by one of the fellow POWs, into this very sort of sallow, hollowed out, very bitter, very headstrong, very determined figure. And he is put in charge as a very experienced escaper of what's called the X organization. And that is there to take control of escape attempts. And also what's often forgotten is to relay intelligence back to the UK. And so he's got a sort of two-pronged job, if you like.
So just set the scene for us. There has been a successful escape from Stalag Luft 3, hasn't there, in the spring, I think, or a little bit earlier, the famous wooden horse escape. So despite the very unpromising location of the camp, you know, it is really in the middle of nowhere. You've got to cross hundreds and hundreds of miles of hostile territory to get any chance of actually achieving freedom. But there are precedents. And so after this, the success of the wooden horse escapade, the scene's now set for this much more ambitious, huge, great mass escape. So just tell us a little bit about that.
I think the wooden horse, it's important to remember, Stalag Luft 3 is vast and there are lots of different compounds. And the wooden horse escape happened from a completely separate compound. I think that just quickly going back to this, the two-thirds, one-third split between escapers, I think by the time Bushell arrives, I think there is a kind of stagnation in the camp. There have been a few attempts at escapes, but they're largely very amateur. And what Bushell says is, I'm going to put this on a professional footing. And he also says, I'm going to organize a mass escape and I'm going to order the construction of not one tunnel, but three as a kind of double bluff. If they find one, they might not suspect another, and they certainly are not going to suspect a third. And his reason for doing the mass escape, and this is something I explore in my book, and a lot of people say, it was to hamper the German war effort. It was in some way to sort of do their bit to annoy the Germans. I argue very strongly in the book that motivation was entirely flawed. There had been other mass escapes, plenty of other mass escapes throughout the war. And there had been one the year before in which nearly 50 Brits had got out of a camp called Zubin. And what happens during a mass escape is that the Germans organize what's called a kind of a big alarm, a Großfahndung, and they activate anybody in a uniform in Germany just to be vigilant and guard every bridge and crossing. And during this mass escape in 43 by some Brits, an extra 15,000 escaping foreign workers, concentration camp prisoners, and indeed POWs were rounded up under the enhanced security. So in fact, in many ways, you get what we call blowback from manning this. And even the Germans at the camp, when they suspected that something big was happening, advised Bushell directly, listen, if you're going to try and escape, do it in twos and threes. Don't do it in hundreds, because it's not going to work. You're going to create more security around you. We're not going to activate lots of people in Germany to look for two prisoners, but we certainly will for 200-300. And one final point about that is, you're not bringing frontline troops back from the Eastern Front to hunt for prisoners. You're just using members of the Home Guard, the local police, the Hitler Youth, you know, forestry commission equivalents. You know, you're not tying up the German war effort one bit. And in fact, by getting more and more people arrested, you're actually, you know, doing blowback for those who are trying to escape. But something like that didn't cut ice with Bushell. Bushell is thinking, you know what? It's better to do something, and I'm very sympathetic than this, than to sit on my backside in this horrible, crappy camp for the rest of the war. So, you know, I'm sympathetic to both viewpoints. But so when Bushell arrives, you know, he's saying to various chaps, right, it's time you got off your bunk and did something. And certainly some of the testimonies in the Imperial War Museum about Bushell are very unflattering. They said, and I apologize to any listeners who are of a legal bent, but they would describe Bushell as being very lawyerly. I take that to be an insult. I don't know about you two, but I certainly wouldn't want to be described as very lawyerly.
Yeah. Okay. So he's instituted the new plan, as you say, three tunnels, Tom, Dick and Harry. This begins, I mean, it's an astonishing logistical exercise, isn't it? So just give us a sense of that, Guy. I mean, it begins in March 1943, I think, start the tunneling, and it goes on for a year. So, you know, how on earth did they achieve the, first of all, the excavation, the disposal of the soil, the ventilation of the tunnel? I mean, all those extraordinary things that had to be put into place. I mean, it was some effort, wasn't it?
There is no doubt that the logistical and technical effort that went into the Great Escape was absolutely immense. And let's not forget that, you know, the film presents that actually really accurately. But what the film doesn't really present is that for two things, that a lot of the technology behind the tunnels was incorporated from escapes that had taken place over the past 4 or 5 years of war. Prisoners were moved around camps. So they had, well, we did this in this camp, we did that in this camp. And also, these were young men who were brought up on escaping memoirs from the First World War. And so they used to read First World War memoirs in the same way as perhaps we might have read Commando comics in our youth. So again, some of the techniques from First World War memoirs were incorporated into Second World War escapes, because, you know, it was only, you know, what, two and a bit decades later. I think, just as those who've seen the film, and I'm assuming that anybody who listens to Battleground 44 has probably watched The Great Escape. Yeah, certainly bedboards from bunks were used to shore up the tunnels. The ventilation system was these big air pumps, which the air went down empty tins of powdered milk. And the rubber from table tennis bats was used as the kind of flaps and vents within the kind of pump, the bellows system. You have the sand being disposed of very similar to how you see in a film, with kind of drawstring bags hidden under trousers in order to spread the sand around, just on the campgrounds. But I think the thing that the film can't portray is the sheer horror. I mean, it does a little bit, but the sheer horror of being in a tunnel 30 foot under the ground with just bedboards holding up tons and tons of sand. But the worst thing about it was that you tunneled in twos, and you had the man in front of you shoveling, you know, the sand and soil back towards you. And then you were the man behind, you would then put that, you know, on a trolley to go back to the other end of the tunnel, the entrance. But the chap in front, you know, he would be wearing typically just like a kind of loincloth, but often they tunneled completely naked. And so if you were the chap behind, your view for 6 hours a day was your fellow digger's backside in a damp little tunnel. But it gets worse, and this is definitely not a film, because their rations were so meagre and their diets were poor, their bowels were often very loose. So, and there wasn't a convenient, you know, place to go and have what the Germans call a Pinkelpause, or maybe even something a little bit more substantial. So you would be tunnelling your way through, you know, the urine and excrement of your fellow prisoner, as well as worried about a tunnel collapse. So, I mean, if I may say so, it was literally a shitty business. You know, it was horrible, and, you know, it stank, and they were dirty, and they were brave men. And also they had, you know, presumably no sense of smell, because it was horrible.
The thing that I think that strikes one when you're looking at this small obsessive group is that there's a very strong kind of, we're talking specifically about the British here, but also I think it applied to some of the Americans as well. There's a sort of gung-ho spirit, isn't there?
Yeah.
Which is, there's a sort of almost a game-playing aspect. You've just described the horror of the unpleasantness of the actual digging experience, but the kind of ethos surrounding it is quite sort of jocular, isn't it? It's sort of, you know, teasing the Germans and all this. And I think the reason that they're able to do this is because the consequences of getting caught are actually pretty small. And this is something that always struck me in my the books I wrote about William Ash, who's one of the great escapers, often said to be the model for the Steve McQueen character in the movie. And he makes this point himself that, you know, the if you're actually caught having successfully escaped or caught in the process of escaping, all you're looking at is 10 days in the cooler in solitary confinement on bread and water. Whereas if you actually get out and you're helped by, say, you're in Shubin, which you mentioned earlier, and you turn up at a Polish household's front door and they look after you, if you're caught, you're okay. If they're caught, they're probably looking at a death sentence. So can you say something about that, you know, that the kind of the inequity and the consequences of escaping as a American or a Brit from one of these camps, or if you were a slave worker and you escaped, you were instantly, well, you weren't just killed, you were actually flayed almost half to death before then being publicly killed as a warning to others. So there are very, very different consequences for an Allied or an American or British prisoner trying to escape and a Pole or a Ukrainian or a Jew who has the terrible misfortune to be in a concentration camp or extermination camp.
I think there's a two things to look at there, and I think you're absolutely right. It's first of all, the gung-ho aspect, you're absolutely right. And I think the two-thirds who didn't want to escape called the escapers the Tally-ho Brigade. I mean, we would sort of, you know, in today's kind of English culture, we would sort of regard them as massive stonking Sloanes or, you know, sort of rugger-bugger types. You know, they were kind of, that was kind of what they were seen as. And so the more sort of one, people of a more cynical bent just saw them as, you know, sort of kind of upper class twits almost. And there were in some camps, I mean, I can't remember which camp, but one of the POWs put all the escape plans he knew about in a tin can on a piece of paper and threw it over into the German side, informing the Germans about what was going on. Because they thought that, you know, sometimes the collective punishment for escapes, you know, was really annoying for the prisoners who didn't want to escape. So you have this dichotomy, you have this real sort of split amongst the population. And then to come on to your point about the punishment for escaping, yes, I mean, there's this great picture of an escaper called Johnny Dodge, who had got out of a train and was caught on the railway lines. And he's got, there's a picture of him, and it's in my book, of his hands aloft and some guards walking who recaptured him, caught him. And everyone's smiling in this picture, you know, good attempt, you know. Sometimes I think, you know, Bushell was even given the odd bottle of whiskey for, you know, by the commandant in one of his previous camps for, you know, trying and escape. There's often said that there was a duty to escape, and actually technically there wasn't a duty to escape. There was only a duty to evade capture when you were shot down. So you did have a duty not to be captured if you could help it. But there was certainly no duty to escape enshrined in the then King's regulations. There was a kind of corporate duty to escape in the way there's a kind of corporate duty amongst servicemen and women to be brave and to help each other. But there's certainly nothing in the King's regulation says you've got to get out of your prisoner of war camp. But Patrick, where things change and it ceases to be a game, it's literally announced by the Germans. And there's this celebrated leaflet distributed, I think it's in mid to late 43, saying, please, prisoners, you know, escaping is no longer a sport. It's no longer a game. And I think this is on the front of the rules of the board game Escape from Colditz, if you've ever played it. And the prisoners are warned directly that actually the consequences for escaping may well be fatal, even though that breaches the Geneva Protocols, that actually you stand a very good chance of being shot. And again, the commandant at Stalag III said to Bushell and the other senior British officers, listen, what we know is behind this leaflet about escaping no longer being a sport is the fact that Himmler, in charge of the SS and the Gestapo, is taking an increased interest in what you guys are up to on the run. And there's a big chance if you fall into the hands of the Gestapo that actually you aren't going to be treated quite so gently. And you may receive the type of treatment that, you know, one of the other nationalities that Patrick was referring to might receive. So, you know, watch your step. Maybe it's best not to do it. But of course, for people like Bushell, that was just, you know, the idea of not having a go because things have got more dangerous. That was simply not in his DNA.
Now, the plan, Guy, is to get, I think, about 200 out. So it's a huge effort. But how rudimentary were the sort of plans put in place to actually give these guys a genuine chance of getting to freedom in terms of papers and the sort of kit they were going to be wearing? I mean, was there really a reasonable chance for many of them to get away, do you think?
I think the escapers were sort of separated into different categories. And those who spoke a foreign language, a European foreign language fluently, were given the best forged papers. They were given the most amounts of currency. They were told that they were going to travel by train and get as far away as possible. And of course, you've got to remember, only 50% of the great escapers, of the 18 who eventually escape, only 50% were British. And the rest were Poles, Estonians, Norwegians. And all these people had legitimate reasons of being in occupied Europe because their countries were occupied. And so what a Norwegian or a Polish escaper can do is to say, I'm a foreign worker, you know, on leave, heading back home. And no, I don't speak German. I speak Norwegian because I'm Norwegian and you occupied me. So they have got, they're the ones given the best papers. And incidentally, the papers in the film, the forged documents, are often shown to be drawn by hand. And of course, Donald Pleasance famously goes blind, you know, by the hard work he's doing. In fact, quite a lot of the papers were actually forged and printed by the wife of a German guard who had been blackmailed. That had taken place in Hamburg. And so a lot of the escape kit was, you know, got by blackmail, bribery and extortion. And also many of the German guards, you know, were very willing to help because they were quite old, quite poor. They only had 2 cigarettes a day, whereas a prisoner of war had 10 cigarettes a day. So I'd say that when you've got cigarettes being the currency and you've got prisoners being 5 times richer than the guards, I think corruption will necessarily occur. So, I mean, I describe the escape as the greatest Anglo-German cooperation since the marriage of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. And when the escape did happen and the Gestapo came to investigate, they didn't question the prisoners. They went and questioned the guards, and they would go into the guards' apartments and flats and barracks. And they'd open up cupboards and Red Cross chocolate would just fell out, you know, hence the amount of corruption that had gone on. So, yeah, it was. And just the other thing I remember is that people often say, well, there are no Americans on the Great Escape. And technically that's true. Although I think going back to your points, all about the logistics, the other logistics is the security. Trying to keep the tunnels hidden from German detection was partly the responsibility of the Americans when they were in the North Compound, the compound we're talking about, because the Americans were responsible for all the security of the tunnels. So there was a very sophisticated kind of relay system which would warn the tunnelers that Germans had just entered the compound. You know, one guy near the gate would lift up his copy of Wuthering Heights. Another bloke 50 yards away would, you know, light his pipe. And that, by a system of messages like that, you know, they were told to stop digging. So the Americans were responsible for all the security and indeed would have got on the escape had the Germans not moved the Americans from to a different compound just several weeks before the escape took place. But yeah, I mean, it was very ambitious. 200 to 300 getting out. Some would go by train. And to go back to your original question, most were called hard arses. They were given one basic pass, a few quid, some escape rations, and told to walk. And the problem with that is that they didn't have enough kit. If you're going to walk, you know, in what was unseasonably cold weather, in icy, slushy snow, it's 0 degrees. I found the old weather charts. It was bloody cold. You're going to want, you know, today your best polar North Face Berghaus type kit. A lot of them, like Jimmy James, just had desert trousers. He had literally what looked like more or less like a pair of Gap chinos to escape in, you know, which wasn't great. So, yeah. So you have the hard arses who are largely British. And then you have the guys who speak a foreign language. And one of them is Bushell. He's a good linguist, so he will be going by train. He speaks French fluently.
Well, that was all fascinating and intriguing stuff. We'll hear next what happened when the escape actually took place. So tell us about the actual events of the escape. How did it begin?
Well, they begin like, and I don't need to tell you two this, but it is a maxim that every military operation, the minute it starts is the minute your plan goes out the window. And that is exactly what happened that night, because Leslie Bull, who was the first prisoner down the tunnel, was responsible for trying to get the trap door open at the end of the tunnel. And that's a job given to Steve McQueen in the film. And just as in the movie, after about 2 hours, because the trap doors expand and contracted in so many frosts and warming ups throughout the day, takes about 2 hours to open up the trapdoor. And he looks out and finds they've fallen 30 feet short of the woods they're meant to emerge into.
So how long is the tunnel from the north compound to the perimeter?
It's 335 feet, so it's about 100 metres. So the length of the tunnel, that is. And they needed to have dug another 10 metres or so. But it's snow. It's night. They're on a moonless night. There's snow lying around, so they can get out quite quietly. But the other problem is caused by their colleagues in the RAF, in Bomber Command, because Bomber Command are launching a massively heavy raid on Berlin, which, as I say, is only 100 miles away as the Lancaster flies. And that causes all the electricity in the area to be shut down as a precaution by the Germans, which means all the electricity in the tunnel gets shut off, which means there's no lighting system. And so as a result, they have to light tallow fat lamps, little candles, which, of course, is very dangerous when you've got men going in very cramped conditions. You could actually have a fire in this wooden tunnel, you know. And you've got to remember that the dimensions, men were smaller then, but the dimensions of the tunnel are tiny. I mean, they're about the size of, I mean, I'm looking at you through a laptop screen, and the tunnel's not much bigger than a decent sized laptop when you look at it. It's tiny, really small. I mean, these guys are only 10 stone. You know, they're 9.5, 10 stone, they're small. And someone apparently has a panic attack down it. So, you know, claustrophobia was a real problem. And indeed, prisoners were told, can you look at the tunnel first before you escape? Because we don't want people getting panic attacks. People forget to pull the trolley back to get the next guy on, which means that's another delay. People also carrying too much kit with them. One chap's even got a lilo, I kid you not, a lilo, which he thinks is going to be useful to cross rivers. I mean, I couldn't believe it, but there it is. It's in his MI9 debrief after the war. You know, I was told not to take my lilo with me. I sort of imagine it was a bit like one of those big flamingos you get in the pool on holiday. You know, I mean, it's been like, no, you can't take it. They were told to take their greatcoats off because that was making up, you know, that was getting some of them stuck in the thing. So it was very, very, you know, it was a sort of not a cock up from start to finish, because actually, eventually, 80 men do get out that tunnel. And of course, it's, no, that's far short of the 200, but that still is an incredibly impressive achievement. And they start getting out from Memmi at around 11 o'clock p.m. and they manage to escape until about 4 or 5 in the morning as it's starting to get light. And that's when things, I think, in military jargon, then go tits up.
Now, you mentioned the hard asses. Presumably, quite a few of those get picked up quite quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
We know that one or two get, I think three do a home run. And as you mentioned before, very unlikely they're going to be Brits. And that was the case, wasn't it? I think two Norwegians and a Dutchman.
Correct, yeah.
Get all the way to safe territory. Everyone else gets picked up. Just give us a sense of what happens next as far as the bulk of them, and Bushell, of course.
At 4 or 5 in the morning, the tunnel eventually is discovered. Why? Because a patrolling guard notices an enormous amount of water vapour and steam coming out this hole in the ground. Because, of course, you've got all these blokes going down it. It's going to fug up and you're going to get almost like a boiler effluent, you know, coming out of the top. Four guys are around it and they're very quickly arrested, some scarper into the trees. So I take tours to Colditz and the Great Escape every year, Stagler 3. If people want to just Google my name, Great Escape, and Tripsmiths, if I may just say that's the firm. And what I do is I take people to all the kind of places where the hard arses try to get to. And typically, you know, they're barns in the middle of the countryside, villages. Some of them tried to get to local stations and get on goods trains, just like a kind of hobo in the Midwest. And they have a very difficult time. They've got sort of basic compasses they've made, which aren't always that effective. So some of them just walk around in circles. So within 24 hours, you've got the majority of the 76 men on the run are rounded up. And those who are caught near the camp are just sent straight back to the camp. And they do, as Patrick says, they're 10 days, whatever it is, in the cooler, job done. But people like Bushell and those going by train are getting a long way. Bushell managed to make it all the way across Germany to the border with France. He gets to a place called Saarbrücken, which people may have visited, pretty town. And then you've got these two Norwegians who managed to get up to Stettin on the Baltic, and they get on a boat to Sweden. And then at Sweden, they pop into the British consulate and they say, we've just escaped from Stalag of the Three. And the British consul says, well, that's very well done. We'd like a cup of tea. And he sort of goes, well, I think we might want something a bit better than a cup of tea, if you don't mind. But what he does get them is two mosquitoes, which fly from RAF Lucas all the way to Bromma Airport, which is now Stockholm International, whatever it's called. And they end up in Scotland within about 72 hours of escaping from the camp. The Dutchman you refer to is a guy called Bram, or Bob van der Stock. He takes 3 months to get through occupied Europe via his home country of Holland, France, and over the Pyrenees, and eventually is flown to Bristol from Gibraltar. So he has a real epic to get across. So you do have three make what's called home runs, but everyone else gets rounded up. And of course, the tragedy is, of those rounded up, 50 of them are going to have a really horrific fate in store.
So, Guy, what was the Germans' reaction when they heard about the mass breakout?
It's fair to say that one Adolf Hitler was not all that happy about it. Just before the Great Escape, there had been a partisan attack on an SS police battalion in Rome, on the Via Rasella, for those who know their Rome well. And he had ordered a reprisal killing of a ratio of 50 to 1, which even the Gestapo managed to talk Hitler down to 10 to 1. So he was in a very sort of vengeful mode. And so when he heard about the POWs escaping from Salaglov 3, he issued what was now called the infamous, notorious Zargon Order, named after the town where the Great Escape takes place, in which he ordered them all to be shot. At Nuremberg, Goering claimed to have talked him down to a mere 50. But certainly those who were then held at that point, you know, a day or two after the escape, were literally marked men. And you had the head of the Kripo, a man called Arthur Neber, who had actually been a member of the Einsatzgruppen. It was his job to get all their POW registration cards on his desk and select which ones were going to live and which ones were going to die. So, I mean, he was literally a desk murderer. You know, one pile meant life, one pile meant death. And, you know, he would look at the cards and go, oh, that one looks a bit young, I'll spare him. Well, that one's got kids, I'll spare him. That one doesn't have any children, I'll kill him. So what happened to those, and I think Bushel serves as a very good example of the horrific manner in which these young men were killed. In the film, of course, they are mown down by I'm not very good on my weapons, but, you know, a Spandau or something in a field. And it didn't take place like that. They were murdered in twos and threes. Bushel was murdered with his escape partner, a free French pilot called Emil Scheidhauer. They were captured near Saarbrücken. They were taken by the Gestapo back to the camp, which was driving all the way across Germany. And after about 10 or so miles outside town, they were asked if they wanted to have a Pinkelpause, i.e. a pee stop. They then did so, and as they were peeing, they were both shot in the back. Scheidhauer dies instantly, but Bushel doesn't, and he's writhing on the floor. And, you know, obviously you've got to imagine also he's in the middle of urination, so this is about as undignified and as unpleasant as you can imagine. And then the Gestapo officer bends down and shoots him in the head to finish him off. They are then taken to the local crematorium where the death certificates have already been prepared before their death, saying they were shot while trying to escape. Ashes are burnt, and then they are dispatched across Germany to Stalag III, along with the ashes of 48 other recaptured escapers. And the mood in the camp when those urns start appearing, you know, one by one, two by two, it's very apparent that this is murder. And it's the commandant, a man called von Lindeiner, is so incensed with his fellow countrymen that he says to the POWs, look, I'm going to pay out of my own pocket for you to build a memorial to these men. And you're going to have whatever tools you need, pickaxes, spades, on the promise that you don't use them for escaping, but on the promise that you'll just use it to build the memorial. And that memorial still stands today. And I always end my tour there. So, yeah, it's really very horrible. And the Great Escape, the reason why we talk about it still today, it's not just a brilliant escape. It's also a murder story, a very, very dark mass murder story. And it was shocking in Britain at the time. And there was a service when the news came back at St. Clement's Danes. That's the one. No, sorry. What's the St. Martin in the Fields in Trafalgar Square? There was a special service there. Clearly, there were bigger murders carried out in the Second World War by the Nazis, but this still had the power to shock.
There was retribution, though, wasn't there, Guy, for some, at least, of the perpetrators?
Yes. So those who were caught quite soon after the war were tried and hanged. And I've written a book all about the, you know, the hunt for Nazi war criminals. But if you work out how many people are collectively responsible for the murders of those 50 men, and it's in the appendix of my book, you know, you're looking at 200 to 300 people, from Adolf Hitler down to a Gestapo driver who's clearly an accessory to murder. Of those, just a handful were brought to justice. And what's very interesting is that even reading, say, letters in newspapers like the Times in about 1948, when we're still trying to execute these men, there was some public opinion that was going, these people were following their duty. They had to commit these murders, otherwise they too would have been murdered. This is nonsense. You read the testimony of the Gestapo chief in Strasbourg, one Schimmel, Albert Schimmel, And he was asked in court, what would you have done if one of your subordinates would have refused to have carried out the murder, carried out the execution? And he says, I would have got someone else to do it. That's it. And, was there any, what would you have done to the bloke refusing? I said, well, I would have done nothing. So, that's, if anyone wants to say to you, these guys didn't have any choice to do it. They did. But they've been radicalized by Goebbels. Airmen were hated. They were called Terrorfliegen. They were called terror flyers by Goebbels because they've been bombing in Nazi Germany for year upon year. And as a result, airmen were the most hated people in Germany.
And so finally, Guy, in your estimation, was the sacrifice of the escapers worth it?
It's a very difficult question, and it's a good question. I ultimately, along with quite a lot of other POWs at the time, think it wasn't worth it. You're not opening, as I've explained earlier, a new front inside Germany. You're not really making any material effect on German resources. The Germans who were sympathetic to the escapers, in the camp, had warned them, don't do it, it's not worth it. Everyone knew by March 44 which way the war was going. But at the same time, I can't help but salute the bravery of these chaps. And actually, the words I always like, there was a very dashing Spitfire pilot who was a POW called Sidney Dowes. And you can look up his obituary, easily found in the Telegraph or the Times. He was quite a boy, a bit of a playboy after the war, had a lot of money, very handsome. And he said, and he escaped for 12 days. And so he was recaptured. And because the 50 had already been shot, he survived. And he was asked, why did you want to escape? And he said, well, you know what? I just wanted to see a little bit more of Germany before the war was over. And that was his reason. I didn't want to sit in this effing camp. Why would I want to sit here? And I'm very sympathetic to that mindset. Why not? If it's so, do you know what? I'm unashamedly ambivalent about it.
Great stuff. Thanks so much, Guy. That was absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know about you, Saul. I thought I knew quite a lot about The Great Escape, but having listened to Guy, it's really made me think about it, not just about the events, but also about the context and about the meaning of it all. How did you react to it?
Yeah, it's extraordinary stuff, isn't it? And he's absolutely right. Well, from playing the Colditz board game from, a young boy, it was all high japes. And you also got a sense that there was, a little bit of pressure put on the people who weren't trying to escape, in the sense that, there was an element of them not doing their bit, that the perception that they were, in effect, cowards. But when you actually hear the reality of what escaping meant and how unlikely, frankly, the average Brit was to get away, and how dangerous it ultimately became when, of course, the Gestapo got involved, it does make a lot more sense that most of the guys actually were prepared to just sit it out.
Okay, well, do join us on Friday when we'll be looking at events in Ukraine and elsewhere, and on Wednesdays for our continuing Battleground 44 series, looking back at the events of 80 years ago. Goodbye.